feel much like leaving. You don't want me to go, but all your tamaracks are needling your beauty in the snow. And I'll see you soon at Christmas, a happy holiday. Oh, how you gonna miss me if I won't go away? I'm overtime, I'm in demand. Give me a sign.
Welcome to Folk Roots Radio Overtime. I'm Jan Hall. This week, St. John's, Newfoundland singer-songwriter Ian Foster joins us to chat about his music and play a few songs live. But before we get there, this is Ian Foster with Man Out of Time from his latest album, 2014's The Great Wave. For more information about Folk Roots Radio, visit us online at folkrootsradio.com.
People say that I'm a man out of time, an old soul with younger eyes. People say that I'm a man out of time, a simple heart and a heavy mind. People say that I'm a man out of time, find a home in a place not mine. People say that I'm a man out of time, that I would spiral in circles till I grew to see the lines. And it seems to me that we are so far out from where we started, and there is no map to the edge of the human heart now. I have jumped ahead, but I came back to find you, my love. 'Cause there are no roads if I'm not walking with you. People say that I'm a man out of time, in my endless quest for the ties that bind. People say that I'm a man out of time. I know the things worth the wait take long years to find. And it seems to me that we are so far out from where we started, and there is no map to the edge of the human heart now. And I have jumped ahead, but I came back to find you, my love. 'Cause there are no roads if I'm not walking with you. Come with me, let's get out of this disappearing now. Come with me.
That was Ian Foster with Man Out of Time from his most recent album, The Great Wave. It came out in 2014. And Ian is our special guest on Folk Roots Radio today. How are you doing today, Ian?
I'm doing very well, Jan. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you join us in the studio. I always enjoy having someone in the studio who is going to give us a chance to talk about their music, but also get to play as well. You have a guitar with you. I'm very much looking forward to that. I always like to start the interviews, though, talking about how you got into music, because I always find that most fascinating. Tell us a little bit about how you started in music.
I started in music by going into the what was then Radio Shack at the Avalon Mall in St. John's, Newfoundland, and playing all of the keyboards until they told me to stop. And my parents took that as a sign that maybe they should get me one. And so they got me a keyboard that for Christmas that had those little sticky tabs with the letter names of the notes for the white keys, and a songbook that had the drawings of the melodies with the note names written inside the notes. And I remember sitting there that first day and learning how to play Hey Jude. It was like all Beatles stuff in this little book, and it was just the melodies, like the single note Hey Jude melody. And I think it might have been Yesterday. And I just learned these first two songs on that day just by just corresponding, looking and saying, okay, that's a C and this is a C, and just playing the notes, just completely fascinated by it. And of course, all the weird effects you could get on those 90s, you know, or 80s keyboards. Early 90s, I think, was when this was. And so my parents took that as a sign to put me in lessons, and that was it. I started with piano lessons when I was about, I think I was about 10 years old.
And then it just became a progression from there, because obviously your main instrument now is guitar, but you started off... Is that because everybody starts off with a piano? I mean, it's the typical place to start with lessons and then maybe move into something like a guitar?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I've actually said to people, you know, let's talk about creativity for 1 second in relation to this. You know, I've said to someone, I was having a conversation with an author the other day. I did a house concert in Toronto over the weekend, and it was at this author's house, and we were having a chat about creativity and where it comes from. And I've said that over the years, I've taught some lessons to people in guitar, and oftentimes the first song I teach them is Smoke on the Water. And, you know, classic riff.
Is that,
know.
Yeah, because is that because of the riff that gets people excited?
Yeah, it's all on one string. It's only four notes, and it sounds like rock and roll, you know, and those three criteria get people excited, you know. And so I've taught, you know, let's say I taught 10 students in that exact same first lesson. I'd say 2 out of 10 would come back the next week, and this has happened a few times over the years, where they'd say, guess what, I learned 2 songs this week. I learned, and I said, okay, what? And they say, Smoke on the Water. And then they play me Smoke on the Water. And then they say, and I made up this other song. And the other song is just the notes of Smoke on the Water reordered, you know? And I'm like, that's the origin of creativity. This is it right here. If you think about, if you expand that to the greatest songwriters and writers and painters and whatever else, it's just that. It's just that your repertoire gets bigger and bigger to the point where what you're drawing from and reordering and creating is suddenly a truly new and unique thing, or at least something that no one can spot the influences eventually, and you're a master then, you know. And so to go back to connect, to answer your actual question, you know, for me, I started with piano, and it was all instrumental, of course. I was learning how to play the instrument, you know, and after a few years of playing it, I started to write songs, and all my songs were instrumental piano songs. And I would enter them in competitions and those kind of things. And then when I got to high school, I picked up guitar, and I did, my school was cool enough to offer 4-credit guitar courses, which was really neat. And so I started playing guitar, and of course, guitar is an instrument that, obviously there's amazing instrumental music that exists for it, but you have to get to a certain level of proficiency before that actually sounds cool. You know, you kind of start with single note things that are the melody, but they don't really sound full or exciting. Then you move on to like chords, and you go through that. And if you get through that jungle, then you get to maybe finger style music and stuff that actually sounds cool instrumentally. But a lot of people end up stopping somewhere in the chord vicinity, you know. And because of that, I started to write, I guess, what you would call popular songs, you know, like pop songs, you know, songs with lyrics and words, because the instrument just seems to lend itself to that particular medium, you know. So it was only after I started playing guitar that I started to write lyric songs, just, I guess, out of necessity for that. Anyway, that's my own interpretation of why that happened. And then, of course, that became eventually what I did and what I still do. You know, I like to write story songs, and obviously songs with words, and guitar just tends to be the instrument that comes out on, and it's obviously an easier instrument to tour on as well. And so that's what I play mostly these days. But I mean, with that said, I mean, every album seems to have at least one piano-based song on it as well of mine, so I still do keep it up.
So we started with Man Out of Time from the latest album, The Great Wave. Tell us a little bit about that song.
Man Out of Time, that one in particular is not sort of a straight story song of mine. I remember writing it fairly quickly. I have sort of memories of being in a park in the summertime writing the lyrics to this particular song. And I think it actually came, just trying to remember the original origin of this, I think it actually came from reading an article, funny enough, about Ron Sexsmith, the great songwriter out of Toronto. And the article stated, Ron Sexsmith is a man out of time. And I think it was referring to the fact that Ron really writes, you know, he's got that sort of Brill Building writing thing going on, you know, historically. Like, they were kind of, the argument was like, if Ron existed, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, he'd be like the top guy in some ways, you know. And I mean, he certainly has an amazing career now, but, you know, it's just the type of writing that he does and the music that he makes, sort of, you know, it just kind of fits. It's not even that it fits the style of that time. It's like it fits the philosophy of that time. And so I started to think about the concept of being a man at a time, someone with maybe not even necessarily certain like morals, but just like a certain attitude towards life, a certain outlook that might be either forward or a little behind whatever the current time is. But regardless, it's just out of time. It's like the idea of personal time travel in a certain way.
So with a song like that, is that a song where you have a melody that you decide to put a lyrical structure to, or are you also working on lyrical ideas before you actually have a melody to go with those words?
In the case of that one, the words came first. I remember I wanted it to be very spare sort of verses, which they are, in terms of, you know, it's a descriptive thing. You know, I started with that concept of being a man at a time. So there's a lot of allusions to things like the first verse, you know, old soul with younger eyes, you know, a simple heart but a heavy mind. Like, there's sort of a lot of contrast going on there. And so most of the lyrics for that part of it came from that. And then there's sort of a, you know, a sort of a love story chorus to the song. So that one in particular came from writing the words first, and then the music came later.
You have a reputation as being a storyteller as well as a songwriter. You come from Newfoundland. The last album is called The Great Wave, which tends to allude to stories, you know, in the material on the album. Do you find yourself spending time writing down ideas that may eventually become songs? Is that you know, do you tend to collect stories that could eventually form the basis for a song? Or is it just as they come that you tend to work on them?
Yeah, I think it's probably the first one. You know, I do tend to write down everything that comes to mind as I do it. To be honest, in our current age, the iPhone is very helpful that way. I tend to write down, it's always with me, you know, as it's always with all of us, probably, unfortunately. But if I'm out somewhere, someone says something that triggers, you know, an interesting sort of light bulb in my mind, it's so easy to take it out and in the notes just jot down the idea for later, or even the you know, the sort of the dictation device that comes with the iPhone with a recorder. You know, I could be driving down the highway and just open it and say a note into my phone, you know, something about blah blah blah, and hope that no one ever steals my phone and hears it, because those notes are probably ridiculous. But you know, they eventually can turn into songs. They turn into just a big catalog of ideas and thoughts, and sometimes the song comes out completely whole. There are no notes. It's almost like there's no origin story for the song. It's like the original version is a set of lyrics in front of me. And sometimes it's culled from memories that are 2 years old or little ideas. But I don't actually think that has anything to do with me being a storyteller per se. You know, I think that a lot of artists write that way. The story thing for me is a really organic process. You know, I often tell people, I made a joke at a house concert I did the other day. I got an encore and I said, I'm going to do two songs. The first is a story, you know, it's a 2-song encore. And it's true. Like, the stories are almost, you know, they're equal. They're given equal stature. And I think it's because my stories aren't usually, I wrote this song because, or I wrote this song about. I think that's a very sort of songwriter circle thing that happens that I enjoy. But I think that if I was trying to pitch myself as a storyteller and did that, it wouldn't really be true. You know, I think that that's just what a singer-songwriter does. The average singer-songwriter should be able to tell you why they wrote a song. To me, oftentimes, it seems like there's just a fluid thread through my life that connects some of the stories and the songs. So in other words, you don't necessarily need one to get the other. You know, it's not me sitting down going, okay, here's the backstory so you'll understand the song. But I like to believe that they kind of strengthen and bolster each other. That, you know, there's this story that is somehow related to the song and will allude to certain things in the song. But it would be, you know, it's you know, an adventure that I had, which the story is really cool or funny or whatever. And then there's the song as well that is its own thing.
You have a guitar with you today. How would you like to play something for us?
I'd love to, yeah. what can I play for you? I'll play you a song you were saying the other night. Maybe we'll do a few songs from different records. So maybe I'll play a song. You heard Man at a Time on the newest record. Maybe I'll play a song from my last record, The Evening Light. This is a song called The House, and it's a song that I wrote for my... I wrote it in 2009, 2010. I was on tour at the time. I was driving through New Brunswick. I tell this story a lot at shows, actually. I just came across this old barn in the middle of a beautiful... beautiful farmland in southern New Brunswick, and it was just in the process of falling over, literally tilted on an angle and nails coming out of the roof and all that stuff, and it stood out like a sore thumb, you know. And I started to maybe write this fictional story about this family, why, you know, who they were that owned this place, that just walked out one day and didn't come back. They never tore this place down, they didn't sell it, it just is there to fall over one day. And as I got closer and closer to home, I started to think about my own history in Newfoundland, and in the last century, like in the 1950s and 40s, there was a lot of resettlement in communities in Newfoundland for various reasons, and people had to do that thing I'd been thinking about, but with their actual homes instead of a barn. You know, they had to literally walk out one day. They couldn't sell it, they couldn't tear it down, they just had to leave. And there are still ghost towns to this day in Newfoundland and in a few remote places because of that. So the barn became the house, and as I always joke, I have to thank New Brunswick for helping me write a Newfoundland song. You don't hear that every day. So I'll play that for you now, The House.
As I stood in front of the house, as it kneeled in front of me, where the roof had sort of caved in, some nails were bared like teeth. And if the doorway was an eye, it held a crooked look of surprise that we had let it get so far down the line. We move on, it's what we do, and we try to let go of all that we've held on to. We're deep down a country road where so few ever go. The house kept a silent vigil for the ones it used to know. But time, it did its work, just like nature, like gravity. And they slowly broke her spirit, as they once did with you and me. But luckily, we move on, it's what we do, and we try to let go of all that we've held on to. As I stood in front of that house, as it kneeled in front of me, I could see in her broken frame the way it all used to be. I guess the poverty of our youth, well, it just went to our heads. But I don't remember the hard times now, I just remember the day you said, we gotta move on, it's what we gotta do, try to let go of all that we've held on to. Well, we move on, it's what we do, and we try to let go. But these things we hold on to.
That That's Ian Foster live on Folk Roots Radio today with a song entitled The House from the album The Evening Light that came out in 2011. I think you have six albums, is that right?
Why would I pause for that? I don't even know my own album discography. I have five albums, I believe. I released an album with a band in 2006, my first solo in 2008. Then I released, no, you're right. I have six. I'm lying. I have two in 2009, an instrumental and another regular proper album called We Begin Here. And then The Evening Light in 2011 and The Great Wave in 2014.
Is there a soundtrack album in there as well? The music from an unmade film? Is that classed as an album?
That is classed as an album. Yeah, it's called Found, Music from the Unmade Film. As I said, it came out the same year as We Begin Here, which is 2009. And it was a complete side project for me. To be honest, I was getting interested at that point in doing some composing for film, some score work. And I also just had a bunch of ideas that didn't really make sense on a proper songwriter album. You know, they were ambient, atmospheric kind of ideas for a couple of tracks, and then also just wanting to explore everything from sort of fun kind of dance beat stuff to like kind of jazzy, you know, lounge music. Like, I just had just interests right across the board, and I figured, well, the one place that where all that would feel appropriate would be if it was a fake soundtrack to a film, you know? And it would also show off a little of what I had in my mind at that point in time, you know, and what I might be able to do with, you know, a scene from a film or, like, kind of just score work. So it was a great process. It was self-produced in my own studio, and it did get me a few jobs in the scoring world, and that sort of dovetail now into something that I do fairly regularly, which is some score work for film, and also scoring what will become two of my own films in 2013, one called One More Song, which is a 10-minute dramatic short, and now Keystone, which we're just literally finishing in August 2015 here, a 15-minute dramatic short.
So this sounds to me as it's almost like the working with the musical aspect of your art in the same way that you work with the lyrical aspect, that you might, you know, put things down that you might want to use later and incorporate into a song from a lyrical point of view, but you also have musical ideas that in this case could be, they could be used for soundtrack work, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're two different beasts, which is what I liked about it for a couple of different reasons. I mean, the most, one of the reasons actually is related to just being your own boss versus serving somebody else. It's nice after so many years of sort of staring at the blank canvas and writing whatever you want to have someone come in with a product that's half finished and say, make this better somehow, you know, but here's the constraints, you know, I want it to sound like this or be in this kind of mood, or this is the emotion I'm trying to convey in a scene, or those kind of things that relate to composition. So that was great because that's a cool challenge and it's just a different side of the brain to do that. And I think that the other difference is that, you know, if you could approach the music the same, instead of lyrics, you now have a visual element, you know, so instead of hearing words and trying to suit the music to the words, you're seeing a scene, you know, a picture, which as we've all heard is worth 1,000 words. And that does shift how you approach the music. You know, you have to be, it's a great lesson, I think, in subtlety and in intensity and color and dynamics. All those things are important tools for the trade for a composer, even more so. It should be tools for the trade for every musician, but even more so for a composer in some ways, because, you know, if it's a heavy dramatic scene and you go super dramatic in the music, it's just over the top and cheesy, you know, so you end up having to look for like the subtext of what's going on and like you know, maybe an alternative color, you know, maybe if somebody is yelling at somebody, the thing you're playing musically is not angry music. Maybe it's sad music because the anger is coming out of the person actually being sad. You know, it's those kind of things that it can be quite an intellectual process in some ways, as much as it is like a raw emotional process. So yeah, I really enjoy it.
So I assume under those circumstances, it actually is basically sitting down, watching the film in its uncut form and then trying to decide how you feel moved to create music? Is that the way it works?
To an extent, yeah. I mean, certainly in my own filmmaking, being a composer helped because I got to see films in various stages of undress, you know, prior to sort of going into, you know, making one myself. So, like, as a composer, you're sort of seeing a film usually in a rough cut, and a rough cut can be anything from, you know, it can be just after picture lock sometimes. So what picture lock is basically the film has been shot and it's been edited, but the color hasn't been finished. The sound hasn't been finished, so you're hearing, like, microphone levels are totally different. Some stuff is just super loud. You know, there's no sound effects. There's nothing. You're literally seeing, you know, sort of... And the colors are different, you know. One scene is brighter, and they cut to another actor, and it's darker. And those are all things that are, you know, fixed in color correct and fixed in audio. And all things that, to be honest, it would totally take the average person out of it. You know, like, you would watch it and be like, this is not a good movie. And then you'd see those things fixed as they will be. And you're like, wow, this is a great movie. Like, it's amazing to see that process. So that was great for me because I got to see a number of films in that stage and work with films in that stage. So that was a good learning tool for me. And the other thing is, you know, you're really at the service of the director. I mean, that's, you know, like I said, it's a service job instead of, you know, just a, you know, unless you're, you know, I don't know, some crazy, I was going to say, unless you're like some crazy composer who's like super famous. But even then, I think that the ones that are super famous because they constantly serve the director's vision. That's how they got to be as good as they are. They're very good at serving the vision and talking to the director and having open communication about what the director's vision for the film is and what they want to achieve. And your only goal as a composer is to make that better.
Do you see more soundtrack work in your future?
Absolutely. Yeah, I enjoy it. As I said, it's just something that it's a totally different space of the brain than performing music. And I've been very lucky in a way because I've been able to do a bunch of different things in this industry that I really enjoy at the same time, or kind of, you know, back to back. Like this year, I've been down to the States for a tour, and right now I'm on a tour doing a couple of festivals here in Canada. But two of the things that have taken up the majority of my time this year are this film, Keystone, which we have a website for. I should shamelessly plug it here. Keystonefilm.net is the website. We just released a trailer yesterday for the film. And also some production work. I've been producing some artists back home, and the artist I've been working with this year is a girl named Kat McCleavy. Great young songwriter. We just finished her record. It's finished being mixed. We should be getting the master back today or tomorrow, as a matter of fact, to listen to while I'm here on the road. And that's been a really wonderful process as well. Again, another side of the brain. You know, you're working as a producer to help shape songs, work on arrangements, make them as good as they can be. So that's another hyper creative job that is just different than writing songs yourself and going out and playing them live.
Let's play another song live in the studio. What would you like to play for us this time?
Let's keep going back and back. This is from my 2008 record, Room in the City. It's a song that I actually hadn't played at all this tour, but then the last two shows, for whatever reason, I guess there were people there that were asking for it, I started playing it again, so it's on my mind. So I'm going to play this with a single from that record. It's called If the Weather Holds. If the weather holds, we will walk under the dark clouds and not fear what may befall us, for we can never know. If the weather holds, I may see you in the distance. Right before my eyes, a clear sky will start to show. If the weather holds, you will stand up from your table and you will dry the eyes you cried out over wine and cigarettes. If the weather holds, maybe I'll hear your voice again from rooms we've now left empty, saying words you now regret. You feel you could have been more. Tell me, what are you worth, my love? What are they selling you for? You feel you could have been true,
Oh, tell me, what are you worth, my love? And what is this worth to you? If the weather holds, I will look for you and others in the fading light of autumn along sidewalks grown cold. If the weather holds, I may make it back by nightfall with a walk that's new and careful along a path that's grown old. If the weather holds, I still brace against the wind that howls within the margins of this life that I move through. And if the weather holds, maybe you will close your eyes at sundown, think about finding an answer the way I think about finding you, yeah. You fear you could have been more. Tell me, what are you worth, my love? What are they selling you for? You fear you could have been true. Oh, tell me, what are you worth, my love? What is this worth to you? Tell me, what are you worth, my love? And what is this worth to you now? If the weather doesn't hold, I will write the song that breaks you out of the downpour and into the light, yeah. If the weather doesn't hold, I will sing it to the windows and hope that it would float its way to you in the night. You fear you could have been more. Tell me, what are you worth, my love? What are they selling you for? You feel you could have been true. Oh, tell me, what are you worth, my love? And what is this worth to you? Tell me, what are we worth, my love? And what is this worth to you now? Tell me, what are we worth, my love?
That's Ian Foster with a live version of If the Weather Holds from the album Room in the City. Ian is our guest on Folk Roots Radio today. We're playing a few songs, chatting about his career. I'd like to chat with you about your live experience, because you've obviously been a singer-songwriter for quite a while. You're also on the road quite a lot, and I imagine pretty much every show you do on the road is a solo show.
Often, yeah. I do some duo work with my partner, Nancy. She sings on my last two records as well. So when we can, we tour together as a duo. And we did part of the current tour in Nova Scotia. This tour, I played Nova Scotia shows with her. But yes, there are a lot of solo shows for sure.
Do you like playing solo on the road? I mean, is that the preferred way to share your music with the audiences that you meet on the way?
I mean, I do have a band back home that I'll play occasionally with as well. I mean, I love that experience. I mean, they're just very different experiences, you know. There's something about the solo experience. I've been doing it that way for a long time, and I do really enjoy it. There's something that I get out of it that is different than what I get out of about a band show. I wouldn't say it's better, because again, it's just you get different things out of those experiences. There's a different energy. You're usually playing a different kind of venue if you're playing solo versus a band. But I kind of got into this because I'm a bit of a communication junkie, you know? And I don't mean that in the way that I just read a lot of newspapers and you know, want to know what's going on. I do want to know those things. But for me, it's like feeling a connection with somebody and starting a conversation that's really interesting with somebody and kind of getting right down to it, you know, getting down to how that person sees the world and, you know, figuring it out, you know, that sort of thing as best we can. That's always been of interest to me. And I just feel like there's more odds of that happening, it seems, at a solo show. You know, there's an interaction that comes with a more intimate venues where you can have that dialogue with people. And I think that when it's really good, you connect with people in a way that they truly never forget, you know, like they walk away feeling like they had a really personal experience. And, you know, and I've been lucky enough over the years to, you know, to get emails from people who have been to shows, you know, in all kinds of places, whether that's overseas or here in Canada or down in the States, like the day after or a few days after a show. And they, you know, they articulate something to me, you know, personal, that maybe one of the songs connected with them, or they tell me a story or something. And I mean, that's really what it's all about. You know, when you get those messages, you sort of sit back and sort of have a little moment to yourself, you know, where you're like, yeah, this is why I do this, you know. And those moments seem to come, you know, I've had great experiences with people reacting to the band as well, but it seems like those moments particularly come in solo experiences.
You mentioned house concerts that you talking about an experience from this tour. Do you find house concerts to be a fun thing to do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the best, you know. I think that done properly, a house concert is a fairly ideal situation for a folky storyteller musician. You know, I think that if you can get, you know, 50 to 70 people in a room, you know, which, you know, is not every house concert for sure. And you can have less and it's still amazing, you know, it depends on the size of the house, really. But if you can get somewhere in there to come into a room and they're willing to come in and pay and for an experience that is a you know, a one-off specific experience, you know, of seeing an intimate show, it's financially good for the artist. It's artistically good for the artist. It's emotionally good for the artist and for the people who are at the show, because they've walked away with something special. You know, it builds community. I really don't see a huge downside. I know that there are certain venues that complain about house concerts because they feel like it's hurting the venue. But I think that, you know, the reality is those venues need to look at the symptoms that caused this thing to happen. And a lot of the symptoms for most people, it seems, that I host or that I perform at, you know, their houses, they seem to say, you know, we just kind of got sick of going to the bars and having a subpar experience, you know. And this is not every bar by any means, or every venue. There are amazing venues out there that work very hard at being presenters, obviously, and they're the ones you search out as the diamonds in the rough, you know. They're the ones that are the trendsetters or whatever. But there's a lot of venues where it's sort of, you know, it's more about the booze than it is about the performer. You know, the clientele could be drunk and kind of ruining the show. And I mean, I've performed concerts in bars where there was a, you know, $10 or $15 ticket, and there's like a couple of people kind of ruining the show for everybody. And I feel bad for the people who came to the show to watch me play, because they're not getting their money's worth, you know? So in all those senses, you know, the house concert is sort of the remedy for that. It's the chance for both the performer and the audience to have a really respectful night. And everybody is sort of open and friendly enough that they're ready for something cool to happen. And I think that's the difference, you know? It's like, I hear a lot of comedians talk about doing comedy clubs, and they talk about how, like, and I thought there's really funny bits that they do about this, but the idea that the audience is already mad before they've gone on stage because they had to find parking and it was really warm, they had to walk far to the venue, and then they had to pay to get in, they have to order food, so they've now it's $100 night for them, and it's, you know, like they're already kind of irritated before they watch the show, and like the comedians are like, this is what we have to like bring them up from, is just being and there's a certain truth to that about going to venues. You know, you go downtown, you're trying to find parking, it takes you 20 minutes, you have to walk a mile to get to the place, and you know, the air conditioning's broken or whatever it is. And I just think that there's, you know, the house concert, everybody is ready to have an awesome time. And it often leads to like really special moments in a show.
And what about the festival experience?
Also a wonderful thing for sure. I mean, the thing that a house concert, the probably the downside, which is fairly obvious of a house concert, is that the numbers are small. Now, it is about quality, not quantity. But at the end of the day, to survive as an independent artist who's touring all the time, you kind of do need a lot of people to see you, because, you know, when you go back to a region, you know, not all of those people who saw you the first time are going to be able to make it. You need to have like enough people see you that even if a small percentage comes, it's still a show of some sort. So I think that the festival, aside from just the general things of festivals, can be really fun, and it's summertime and it's nice to be outside. those are the obvious festival things. I think that for the artist, it's the chance to play on a bigger stage for people who, again, all came for the music. Even if it wasn't specifically yours, they came because they wanted to hear music and experience that in a nice way. And if you're playing the right festivals, it can be a great exposure thing to then go back to those regions where the festivals were and play again. And then the other thing about festivals is people will travel for certain festivals, so you'll actually, your reach could be much farther than you could ever conceive. You know, suddenly there's people in the States that want to host you for a house concert or tell you here's a great venue in town because they saw you somewhere in Canada, you know. So yeah, the festivals I think is another important side of the coin.
And I imagine also the workshop experience where you can share the stage with other singer-songwriters, other musicians that may bring a little, something a little different to the time you spend on stage together.
Yeah, I mean, if we were really going to unpack this, we'd have to do a 9-part series probably of how a career works, you know. But I mean, I think that it's all like, it's all a drop in the bucket at the end of the day. And as you, like, it's one of those things that, you know, I've definitely got my like 10-year pin now at doing this professionally. It's one of those things that you learn. You truly learn as you've been doing it for a while that there probably is no magic golden ticket. You know, there's no thing, you know, there's very rarely a, here's a very dated reference, a Ricky Martin on the Grammys, you know, there's a dated reference for you, you know, where it's like, and then he was famous, you know, or then he was okay. You know, it's very rarely that. It's more like, you play that house concert and you move people and you have a wonderful chat with them and it's a beautiful experience, and then those people tell two friends, and then you do a festival and you get seen by a lot of people, and maybe one of them lives somewhere else that you've never been and opens up a door for you, or you play a workshop stage as you just mentioned and you meet another wonderful singer-songwriter who shares the same vision as you and you do a mini tour together or something. And then it always feels like, you know, I could look back now. I've done it long enough that I can actually look back at least a little tiny bit. And I can sort of go, okay, yeah, 5 years ago, that cool thing happened because A, B, C, D, E, and F thing happened. Like, it's never one thing. It's always like a bunch of things. And they all came together in some way that allowed me to do whatever that thing was.
I'd like to see if we could try and squeeze another live track in before we finish.
Of course.
I'm kind of hoping, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Okay.
When I've seen you play before, one of the songs that I loved, because the story that comes with it as well, is An Open Letter from the Island.
Okay.
Can you play that one for us?
I will see what I can do for you. I would love to play it for you. I haven't played it in many months now, I don't think. So this could be...
That surprises me, because I know a lot of people absolutely love it. I put the video online in preparation for this.
And right.
People
right.
say, oh, I love that, you know, because it's all about the island. And
sure,
everybody
sure.
loves Newfoundland.
Sure, yeah. No, I mean, I don't have anything. There's no real reason why I haven't been playing it. Like, I don't have a, you know, I hate that song now. It's not like anything like that. I just haven't been. So maybe we'll, through the magic of radio, we'll pretend it was one performance if I have to start over. I'm just kidding. Yeah, but it I'm glad you're letting me play it on the radio show, because it's, I think it does require some explanation sometimes, you know. It's a little context, I suppose, more than explanation, you know. This song came from being on the road years ago now. I can't remember when I actually wrote this song, but I remember being, I had done a BC tour, which must have been 5 years ago at least now that that happened. So it was a while back. I had just encountered a bunch of people that had, you know, the typical stereotypes that we've all heard about Newfoundland, you know, and some of them are like, some of them are very innocent and some of them are obviously less innocent. I mean, to be honest, you know, you and I were out for a walk today and we encountered a girl and she said, oh, Newfoundland, it's like snowy there 11 months of the year. That's obviously not true. You know, but like,
it's like 10 and a half.
That's right. It's all right. It's like 10 and 3 weeks. Thank you. This is like a little kid, right? When you say, how old are you? They're like almost 10, you know, it's like that. No, but I mean, like, obviously that's, and I mean, that's innocent enough. Like, why you wouldn't get mad at someone because they thought your weather systems were different than they think. But that is, you know, it is just a misconception about the place. But of course it gets, you know, an accent is obviously like one of the top ones after that. I mean, every show I do, I'm asked, where's your Newfoundland accent? Every single time. It's never a doubt. Which, again, is not a big deal. But there was a few events that happened on this particular tour. I remember being in New Brunswick, and I played this show. And there was a lady there in the dark halfway through the show who shouted out, "Ian, you have the most lovely voice." And I said, "Wow, thank you very much." And then she immediately followed that with, "I was expecting some toothless newfie singing, 'Eyes the buys, the bills the buys,' but you're awesome." And of course, as I joke at shows, you know, it's called Eyes the Buys, the Bills the Boats. You know, you got to correct them. We can't build other buys. Buys are people, and that would be cloning if we did that. You know, a couple of weeks later in Montreal, there was this gentleman who came up to me and he was like, number one new fan, you know, like he was like, "Oh, the pedals and the things." I was using electric guitar at the time. He's like, "The effects you're using, the second verse of the third song," like he was so into the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to people like that. Obviously, talk for 10 minutes was great. And then he said, "So you're from Newfoundland? I bet you got the hell out of there as fast as you could." And I said, no, you know, it's my home. I sort of passive aggressive did a little bit, you know. And he said, "Really? I can't imagine living there." I said, "Have you ever been?" He said, no. So, you know, there was just a bunch of these tales. And this was all the same tour for some reason. So I guess the universe was trying to veer me towards writing this song. So the song, the context of the song, where it came from, was me sort of going, I need to write an open letter to these people. You know, I need to say, you know, here is a sometimes comedic, hopefully mostly comedic, address of everything in the verses is something, it's a response to something that somebody said to me like that. And just addressing those stereotypes, you know. And the chorus is, it starts with, "This island's in my blood." And that's very true. You know, I was born and raised in Newfoundland. It is my home and I love it to death. And but it's something that it's a place that you, like many places in the world, I think you have to go to a place to truly understand it. And a lot of my songs, if I was to play you a set and talk about them, that would be a theme. If the song is about a place, oftentimes it's because I went there and it broke down maybe a preconception that I had about it, and then it opened up the reality of the situation to me, you know. And I think Newfoundland is often one of those places. And I will certainly say that most people are very good about it, and most people, it's true, when they bring up Newfoundland, they're like, "I love it. I spent a week there." You know, the people who have really great things to say about it are always like, "I went there. Like, I spent a week there, and I want to go back again because it was magical." And I'm always like, "That's cool. I appreciate that's a wonderful thing, you know." So, yeah, I think I've explained that one to death. So I'll play this one for you now. An open letter from the island. "I'm gonna tell you a few things you may find hard to believe. I grew up with running water and access to TV. And I've never fished from a fishing boat, although I love the sea. Just a couple of things that you should know about me. I don't play the fiddle, and I don't drink every day. These are all my original teeth, and I pay my own way. So don't ask me for an Irish song, 'cause they've all been overplayed. It's not the music I come from anyway. This island's in my blood, I'm its biggest fan, but it's a private love that so few understand. And I'm not what you expected, since you didn't expect very much. So I'm just here to put you and reality back in touch. I've got a university education, I've probably read more than you. It's funny you think we're backward, it's such a backward sort of view. But that we all just mess around, we were probably making fun of you. Just a couple more things I hate to tell you are true. Well, people ask me, where's your accent? And I try to be polite, even when they can't pronounce Newfoundland right. Canada Day, when you celebrate, we mourn those who died selflessly at Beaumont Hamel, so we can all live in this land of the free. This island's in my blood, I'm its biggest fan, but it's a private love that so few understand. And I'm not what you expected, since you didn't expect very much. So I'm just here to push you and reality back in touch. Well, we were all born orphans here, we were all born without love,
And so we learned how to love ourselves, and we learned how to rise above. So don't take this as patriotism, or as the words of a bitter man. I just know who I am. This island's in my blood, I'm its biggest fan. But it's a private love that so few understand. And I'm not what you expected, since you didn't expect very much. So I'm just here to put you and reality back in touch.
You know, I want to thank you for playing that for me today.
No problem.
It's interesting, the story, because actually I think the reason it resonates with me so much is because it's not just that stereotype that it's actually putting in its place. Because I think we all at different times feel stereotyped for different reasons, whether it's because of the way we speak, whether it's because the way we dress, whether it's because of our religion, our sexual orientation, a whole range of different things. And there is that assumption that can be made.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that the very first time I played this outside of Newfoundland was in London, Ontario. And I had actually played it for a few friends I was staying with there because it was newly written at the time. And I'm like, but I can never play this, you know, outside of Newfoundland. It was actually a belief of mine at the time, just because, I don't know, I assumed that it would either be, I assumed that there was a couple of levels of difficulty there, you know. The main one being, to be honest, that it was so specific that it might not be relatable at first, you know. And they were like, no, you got to play this. And the first people that came up to me about the song were from Saskatchewan, and they said, you know, I totally get this song. And of course at the time it seemed shocking, because I'm like, well, you know, what two places in Canada could be more different than the prairies and like the far east coast, like coastal oceany, you know? But their point was, they said, you know, when we first moved here, I had people say, why would you live in Saskatchewan? There's nothing there. You know, you can watch your dog run away for days, et cetera, you know, all the stereotypes. And that was the moment that, just like you just said, it clued into me that I'm like, right, because this is true. Because we all, every province has stereotypes about each other, every place in the world. I've toured in Europe, you know, and you'll go somewhere and you'll say, well, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah, but those guys over there, like, it's actually, I saw a great article about this, not to get off on too much of a tangent here, but I think it might have been Bill Nye the Science Guy. He was talking about how racism is not natural to us, but it like the probably the closest thing would be tribalism. Because if you go right back, even the earliest tribes would be like, it wouldn't be based on like skin color or anything, but it would be based on them being like, well, we're cool, but like those guys over there, though, you know, like there'd be that kind of debate. And if you think about it, it kind of boils down to that. It's the idea that you're in your corner of the world and you've got your people, and then there's, you know, you have misconceptions or beliefs about those people, whoever those people are. And it's obviously crap, you know. It's obviously like, once you go to be with those people, there's endless stories of kind of going like, wow, these people are wonderful, what was I thinking? But you're right, it does, I think, tap into that sort of that basic stereotype thing.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks for playing that for us today. I'm gonna see if I can squeeze one more song in.
Okay,
I'll let you choose it this time.
Okay,
what are you gonna play?
Okay,
for us.
Okay. Yeah, see, this is the problem with me. Like, we could just talk for an hour. Yeah, I'm going to play this one because it's somewhat relevant to what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm headed to Blue Skies Festival tomorrow in Clarendon, Ontario, and it's very near Charbot Lake. And, excuse me, I had spent some time in Charbot Lake a few times for shows, and I actually ended up, I think I just hung out there for 3 or 4 days in a row in a particular October a couple of years ago. And it was beautiful weather, and it's, you know, it's beautiful lakes and nature up there. It was unseasonably warm, like 25 degrees or something on this particular October day. And I decided that I'd just go for a walk, and I was feeling really good. And I wrote this song that I feel like is my only walking song, if I could describe it as a walking song. It's more the beat than the lyrics, of course. But yeah, it just came out of that region, and it was like a nice little gift to me from that particular part of Ontario that I'm heading back to tomorrow. So seems appropriate to play it now. It's called Right Here.
Seems like now we cross the river wide. Seems like now got you by my side. Now all we gotta do is try to remain true to the little bit of grace these wandering hearts provide. Seems like now we're at a mountain low. Seems like now it'd be easy to let you go. But I don't want some twist of fate losing me your pretty face. Don't know much, that's one thing that I know. Oh, what does it mean? All these spaces in between. Losing love and letting it set you free. Or maybe it's easier than you ever thought it could be. Slow down, darling, stay right here with me. Seems like now I've been on the road so long. Seems like now your voice is just a song. Sweet and low, something I need coming to me on the breeze, breaking my heart just before it's gone. Oh, what is it mean? All these spaces in between, losing love and letting it set you free. Oh, maybe it's easier than we ever thought it could be. Slow down, darling, stay right here with me. What does it mean? All these spaces in between, losing love and letting it set you free. Or maybe it's easier than we ever thought it could be. So slow down, darling, stay right here with me. So slow down, darling, stay right here. Slow down, darling, stay right here with me.
That's Ian Foster with Right Here live on Folk Roots Radio today. It's been great having Ian join us in the studio. If people want to learn more about your music, how should they do that?
Well, you can find me all over social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and I have an official site as well, which is ianfoster.ca. As earlier mentioned in the interview, if you did want to check out anything about my new film, Keystone, it's at keystonefilm.net. And I would also recommend that you Google Kat McCleavy. She's got this great new record coming out called Evergrown. I was happy to produce it, and her name is K-A-T, and then M-C-L-E-V-E-Y is Kat McCleavy, so check her out. She's awesome.
You did mention that you had a trailer for the Keystone film. In just a sentence or two, do you want to just give people a little bit of a teaser as to what it's about?
Absolutely. The general conceit of the film is that in the near future, there is an organization called Keystone that specializes in making your most cherished memories unforgettable. Basically, making them keystones in your mind is where the name comes from. So through an off-screen medical thing and an on-screen interview process, which is what the film sort of focuses on, people can go in and tell their most cherished moments, and sort of in an age of forgetting, you know, in an age of Alzheimer's, dementia, these sorts of things, people can, you know, have these moments that they will never forget no matter what, is the general idea. And so our main character, Jack, goes in for his interview, which you watch on screen with the interviewer, and then through a series of flashbacks, you see his memories, and they all seem to focus around this one particular woman. And the sort of mystery of the film is why, and what is he trying to, why does he feel this connection? What is the story of their connection, and what is he hoping to get out of it in the end? So that's what Keystone's about.
That's good. We definitely check that out online. And that was KeystoneFilm.net. Great. We'll definitely check that out. We're going to finish with a song, but from the album The Great Wave, which is your latest release, came out in 2014. You've chosen Hannah as a song we're going to play. Do you want to tell us about that one?
Sure. Well, in an hour interview, you know, it's sort of like an hour album, you know. We started with the first song, seems symmetrical to finish with the last song. Hannah is the story. It's not a direct story song. It's actually a collection of events that just I drew from this particular fall. And I was home from touring at the end of this fall, feeling a little bit uninspired at the time at the end of this particular tour, going through some stuff personally. And then, unfortunately, my partner Nancy's friend Hannah passed away at a very young age. She was only 27. It's worth noting I never met Hannah personally, but through learning about her passing at sort of near the end of that fall, I learned about her more and more in the days that followed from Nancy. And I just learned that she was this wonderful person, this light in the dark, you know. I saw lots of pictures of her, and she was always smiling and happy, and she did a lot of good for people. I remember Nancy telling me, like, hundreds of people turned up for her funeral, you know, and she was only 27, but she had affected that many lives with how bright a person she was in just her short time on Earth. And so we learned that universal lesson that we've all too often forget and hate to relearn, which is that life is short. But there was also sort of the added lesson of, you know, we have to do the best we can with the time that we're given here. And I felt sort of that Hannah, the stranger to me, gave me that, you know, as sort of a gift in a way, indirectly. And so the song is not all about her. Like I said, it has sort of moments from a bunch of things in the fall, visions, little fragments. But the main refrain of the song at the end, which is, you were of the few who held the world inside your heart, is very much for her, and it seemed only right that she was strong enough to embody the title of the song as well. So that's why it's called Hannah.
Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. This is Ian Foster with Hannah from the album The Great Wave, and you're listening to Folk Roots Radio, and I'm Jan Hall.
Thank you, Jan.
Heels click on the concrete as the rain plays a few. It's clear and yet confused, and it covers me and you. Back up in our room, I taste the season on your skin. It's cold mixed with gin, frosted glass I can't see in. Noise is such that silence is exception, a secret chance to see the poetry. We notice only when the trees take a breath, instead of giving us the air we breathe. Those trees release their leaves, you let your hair down earlier every single day now. Final rush of heat to your face and to your feet. I watch as you go running through the leaves. This fall has taught us how to lose, but maybe that's something we can use. This fall has taught us how to yearn, so be strong and live the lessons we have learned. Be strong and live the lessons we have learned. The only thing is making sense of this, the life we choose and the ones that we dismiss. Because the years go by in the flicker of a fire that can burn you out or light up your desire to hold the world inside your heart. To hold the world inside your heart. You held the world inside your heart. You were of the few who held the world inside your heart. You were of the few who
held the world inside your heart. You were of the few who held the world inside your heart. You were of the few who held the world.